Tomorrow, in ancient Israel, there would have been a very special offering given, very unique offering that was given. It was something unique among the holy days, something we see commanded as a special part of the events and the activities of these days of unleavened bread. It's easy to sort of read over it because when we read about the offerings, we tend to sort of get a little bogged down in this animal in this style, cut up in this way with these things and this measure of this grain and this measure of this and this and this. And it can get a little overwhelming. And so sometimes when we get to these offerings, we go, oh, and there was an offering. Okay. And we keep moving. Also, we recognize that the offerings all pointed very specifically toward Jesus Christ in various different ways, right? And we see from New Testament example, we're not going to go into the scriptures, but we see from New Testament example how Jesus Christ has fulfilled those offerings, making them unnecessary for New Covenant Christians to come and bring. So we don't bring these offerings, right? We understand that they are a part of God's law, that Jesus Christ then came and he became those offerings and is those offerings for us. But we learn a lot and can learn a lot from those offerings. Again, because they pointed to Jesus Christ. And they teach us things about Jesus Christ. We'll look at one of those offerings today, the wave sheaf offering. The wave sheaf was offered, again, like I said, it would have been tomorrow. It'd be tomorrow, the Sunday after the Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread. Let's turn over to Leviticus 23, and we'll see exactly where it's commanded. Leviticus 23 and verse 10. Now you'll notice this is in the context again of the days of unleavened bread. In verse 4 we see the command is issued regarding the days of unleavened bread. These are the feasts of the Lord, holy convocations. Verse 5, on the 14th day of the first month, at twilight is the Lord's Passover. And on the 15th day of the same month is the feast of unleavened bread. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation, which is what we did this past Tuesday. You shall do no customary work on it. You shall offer an offering made by fire to the Lord for 7 days. We see those offerings described over in Numbers. It says, here's the offering that you're to offer every day of these 7 days of unleavened bread. And the seventh day shall be a holy convocation, and so we'll be here on Monday. And you shall do no customary work on it. Now, right here in the middle of this, he gives this special command. It says, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I will give you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. He shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. It's referring to the Sabbath right here in the context of the days of unleavened bread. And you shall offer on that day, when you wave the sheaf, a male lamb of the first year without blemish as a burnt offering to the Lord. So this is in addition to all the other offerings that were being made during the days of unleavened bread. This special wave sheaf offering was given, and along with it, a burnt offering of a lamb without blemish. Its grain offering shall be 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, an offering made by fire to the Lord for a sweet aroma, and its drink offering shall be of wine, 1/4 of a hin. And you might see some type there in the symbols that we took on Passover, that there was a lamb offered, that there was flour offered, that there was wine offered. You shall eat neither bread, nor parched grain, nor fresh grain until the same day that you have brought an offering to your God. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. That presentation of that first sheaf. Historically, that first sheaf we find would have been reaped on Saturday night after the Sabbath had ended. Would have been reaped on Saturday night. And then it would have been brought as an offering that Sunday. It would have been brought and offered up, and this was the sheaf. This represented, Expositor's Bible Commentary puts it this way, it says, the presentation of the sheaf on the day after the Sabbath symbolized the dedication of the whole year's crop. And until this was done, none of the new grain was to be eaten. So we see an interesting limitation. God commands him, he says, don't eat anything that you reap until you've done this. You have to do this first. You have to offer this. This wave sheaf is going to be the very beginning of your harvest for the whole year. And it represents the first of your first fruits. It's also interesting because if we continue in verse 15, we see that offering on that day is a very special marker that we still rely on today. Verse 15, and you shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. Count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath. Then you shall offer a new grain offering to the Lord. And we see that it outlines the Feast of Pentecost. So it's very specific that offering, that wave sheaf offering, is the day that begins the count to Pentecost. We start counting to the next festival based on that offering, on that day. And again, there's a reason for that. We'll go into that and we'll look at that. But it begins a count. It's very specific in how it outlines that count. It gives us the exact number of days. We even see some nuances clarified for us. There's been the question in the past, well, what happens if the days of unleavened bread start on a Sunday and they end on a Sabbath? Then when is that wave sheaf offering offered? There's a lot of information on this. There's a lot of study and a lot of research. There's a lot of conflicting opinion, but we feel we get a very, very clear picture and a very clear answer to this over in the book of Joshua. Turn over there. Because it is, again, because it's so tied into how we keep the next holy day, it's a big question. It's a question worth answering and worth figuring out. Joshua 5 and verse 10. If you look at the headings in your Bible, you'll look in Joshua 3, you might see something in mine that says, Israel crosses the Jordan. And then they set up some memorial stones. And then they're camped. Here in verse 10, we see they're camped in Gilgal. Now you'll remember, in Leviticus 23, you don't have to turn back there, but in Leviticus 23, God says specifically, when you enter the land which I am going to give you and reap its harvest. Here they've crossed the Jordan. The Jordan was the boundary. You'll recall when they crossed the Jordan, they walked into the Jordan carrying the Ark of the Covenant, and the Jordan stopped. It dried up. God was doing something special, signifying you're entering the promised land, and here he was going before them. So they now enter the promised land. Okay? And we see in Leviticus 23, it says, when you enter the land which I'm going to give you. So here they've done that. They've crossed the Jordan. They're camped in the promised land now. And it says, and you reap its harvest. That's the backdrop. So now we get to Joshua 5. Verse 10, when the children of Israel camped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho, They ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover. Unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. Now, it's very interesting that it tells us here, very specifically, they kept the Passover on the 14th, and they ate of the produce of the land. If you have an old King James, it might say there that they ate old grain. Old is not there in the text. They didn't eat old grain. They were eating the produce of the land. They were eating what they had harvested. So this was grain that they had harvested. It was the produce of the land, and they're there about to eat it. And notice also, it even goes as specific as to say that they ate parched grain. The command over in Leviticus 23 is very specific. You're not supposed to eat any parched grain until you've offered the wave sheaf. And yet we find here that they ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover. That would be right here at the beginning of the days of unleavened bread. The day after the Passover, they would have eaten it. Because the day after the Passover, it's the first day of unleavened bread. You'll recall. The Passover is killed on the 14th. And then the days of unleavened bread begin at evening on the 15th. So they would have eaten grain here on the 15th. Sometime after, presumably, that wave sheaf would have had to have been offered that day on the very beginning of the days of unleavened bread. So presumably we're looking at a scenario here. The only way that that really makes sense in context is that we're looking at a scenario where the first day of unleavened bread was on a Sunday. So we see here that when it falls that way, that the wave sheaf is offered on that Sunday. The wave sheaf is always offered, and there's been a lot of debate about this for millennia, but the wave sheaf is understood that it needs to be offered during the days of unleavened bread. The Pharisees, I believe, they contended with that idea, and they would offer the wave sheaf on the Sunday after the Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread, delaying their count to Pentecost by a week. But as we understand it here, and as we've understood it from the scriptures, and again, we have a study paper on Pentecost observance if you want to dig into it more. But as we understand it, the wave sheaf offering was offered during the days of unleavened bread. I think as we get into some of the New Testament fulfillment, we'll see why that is also very important. This has new covenant significance. We look at this and we say that's very interesting tradition. It's interesting maybe that, you know, they couldn't eat of it until they had thanked God for this harvest and dedicated it. And it's a really nice way of acknowledging God and all of the things that he was providing for them. But it's more than that. It's more than just this agricultural tradition. It has relevance to us. We see in Leviticus where it refers to the sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest. Now, there were two harvests that occurred. There were two early harvests. The earliest harvest would have been the barley crop. The barley, it grows and is ready early and first. There's a second crop in the spring of wheat. So the first crop that would have been reaped and that would have been offered would have been this barley crop, and the second would have been wheat. The barley precedes the wheat, but they're both considered early harvests. They're both spring harvests. They're not the autumn harvest, the later harvest, the bigger harvest. We see these two early harvests. We see that these are types. God actually, I believe he actually set up the agricultural system to give us an example, not the other way around. I don't think he's just using the agricultural system to say, oh yeah, this is kind of like something. I think he actually set up this agricultural system so that he could show us something, so that he could teach us something. We see over in 1 Corinthians 15. Let's take a look there. And verse 20, it says, "But now Christ is risen from the dead and has become the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep." So Jesus Christ is a first fruit. He is the first fruits, and he is called here the first fruits. But we see also that he's not the only one. He is the only one right now that is really fully a first fruit. But he's not the only one that is referred to as a first fruit in Scripture. Let's drop a little bit down in verse 23. Well, verse 22, "As in Adam all die, even so in Christ all shall be made alive." Verse 23, "But each one in his own order." Christ, the first fruits. So Christ is the first fruits. And afterward, those who are Christ's at his coming. Let's turn over to Revelation 14, because we see something very interesting about the reference at that point. So Christ's at his coming will be resurrected, Paul is telling us. But then over in Revelation 14, we see the fulfillment of that event described. Revelation 14 and verse 4. "These are the ones..." So this is back in verse 1. "I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, with him 144,000 having his father's name written on their foreheads." Verse 4. "These are the ones who are not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. And these were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb." So here we see Jesus Christ standing on Mount Zion, and with him these who are called first fruits. So here he has returned, and those who are resurrected with him at his coming, referenced as first fruits. So we see there are, again, there's these two types of first fruits. There's this initial harvest, this that was waved before God, this wave sheaf. And there are these other first fruits that are pointed to. Let's go back to Leviticus 23, because we see a little more about this. You might say, "All right, well, that's a little dicey. Maybe you're trying to stretch some things here, and I don't know about that." Leviticus 23 and verse 20. We see another reference to first fruits, and again, it's not first fruits referring to the wave sheaf. It's not first fruits even referring to the barley crop. Here now, we're told about something that was going to happen on Pentecost, right? This is that second early harvest. There's the barley crop. It was the very first. There's this wheat crop that is harvested around Pentecost. And in verse 20, we see the priest shall wave them, referring to the sacrifices that are described, with the bread of the first fruits as a wave offering before the Lord with the two lambs. Go back to verse 17. "You shall bring from your dwellings two wave loaves of 2/10 of an ephah. They shall be a fine flour, and they shall be baked with leaven. They are the first fruits to the Lord." So this is on Pentecost. There are these loaves that are now made out of wheat, that are baked, that are leavened, that are very different from that initial wave sheaf. Yet still, they're first fruits. They're part of this early harvest. And they're referred to here as first fruits. And again, this is in the context of Pentecost. Pentecost, which we know points to the church and those who would be a part of that harvest at his return. So we see first fruits referring both to Jesus Christ, the first of the first fruits, and to the church. This is why we sometimes refer to Jesus Christ as the first of the first fruits, because there are sort of these two sets of first fruits that we like to talk about: Jesus Christ and his first fruits. But we see here the type now starting to get clear. Jesus Christ, that wave sheaf offering, had to be accepted by God before any of the rest of it could. Before any of the rest of it would even be harvested. Before any of the rest of it was could be consumed, could be used. Jesus Christ had to be accepted first before we could then be accepted as well, before we could be acceptable, before we could be looked at and considered as first fruits. So that's the symbolism that we start to see here. Now I want to look at the New Testament timeline a little bit. So let's start turning over to Matthew 26. I want to digress just a little bit. Because as it happens, tomorrow, which again for us we recognize as being the day that the wave sheaf would have been offered, this year also happens to be a day on which a lot of people will be observing some symbols that might look something like the things that we're talking about. It's this pagan ritual known as Easter that's falsely been associated with what we observe, with what we understand to be true out of the Bible. But let's notice, because there's a discrepancy here, when we're talking about the timeline of the Passover, of the days of unleavened bread, of the wave sheaf offering, we're very closely connected to and talking about the timeline of Jesus Christ, his crucifixion, his death, his burial, and his resurrection. These are all connected. They're all very relevant. So when we see these observances tomorrow, there are some very important things to recognize about things like timeline that become very critical and start to make it extremely clear and very evident that there's no association between the two. Let's go to Matthew 26 and verse 17. We're going to look at, again, the timeline of Jesus Christ's death, burial, resurrection, and offering of himself to God, his acceptance before God, fulfilling that wave sheaf offering and that type. Most of the world observed yesterday as Good Friday, the day that Jesus Christ would have been crucified in their understanding. And then we'll observe yesterday or tomorrow as the day in which Jesus Christ was resurrected. That whole timeline doesn't fit with what Jesus Christ said when he said that he would be in the grave for 3 days and three nights. Matthew 26 and verse 17, we'll start at sort of the beginning of the sequence. Verse 17, now on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus, saying to him, "Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover?" When it says first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, it's referring to the day there leading into the Passover. It's the first of unleavened bread. I've heard this explained as potentially the first of the week there beginning into unleavened bread. But we recognize and we clearly see that this day is not actually the holy day, because we'll look and we'll see elsewhere where the holy day is directly referenced. We know that Jesus Christ himself was killed the day before the holy day. And we see that he took the Passover, right, on the 14th, the way that it was commanded, and then the 15th would have been the holy day. So here they're preparing for the Passover. They're preparing to have the dinner. They're preparing in advance of his betrayal and his arrest. In verse 20, we see Jesus sat down. It says, when evening had come, so when evening had come, right, and now they're into the 14th. When evening had come, he sat down with the 12. So presumably sundown, and Passover begins. And we see him, we go through the rest of Matthew 26. We see the symbols of the bread and wine. Verse 26, he gives them, take, eat, this is my body. And he says, this is my blood. So he gives them the symbols of the Passover. In verse 36, we see that, okay, now they travel across and they're at the garden in Gethsemane. Down in verse 47, we see Judas and the chief priests, they come and they arrest Jesus. We see he's taken by night before the Sanhedrin. We see the whole timeline going along. We see in verse 74, it says that this is where Peter has denied Jesus Christ three times. And immediately a rooster crowed. So we know we're getting on toward morning here. In Matthew 27, we see that morning came. And Jesus faces Pilate. And Pilate tells the people, I know it's your tradition that at the feast, I release to you a prisoner. So in advance of that coming feast, that coming high day that was about to start, he's going to release to them a prisoner. So we see this is clearly the day right before the holy day. And in Matthew 27 and verse 35, we see that this is the day that they crucified him and divided his garments. So here we see Jesus Christ offered and crucified on Passover day. So he'd kept the Passover in the evening after sundown with his disciples. And Passover day, he goes through his trial and his scourging, and he's crucified. Here's where the timeline gets very interesting and sometimes confused. Let's go over to John chapter 19. John chapter 19 and verse 31. Here's where we see this is in advance of the holy day. John 19, verse 31. Therefore, because it was the preparation day, that the bodies should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. So here, Jesus Christ is still on the cross. They're getting toward the end of the day, and the Jews ask that they take these guys down off of this cross because we don't want people on the cross on our high day. And John makes it very explicit. He says that Sabbath was a high day. You'll see in other scriptures here, it's referring to Sabbaths, and sometimes it's all lumped into and confused to be one Sabbath. But here John makes very clear that Sabbath was a high day, which is what it's the sequence that you're used to. It's the sequence we have Passover, we have our night to be much observed, and the following day we come and we have a high day. We're all here and we celebrate that first day of unleavened bread. That's what they're preparing for. So there, that preparation day was in advance of the first day of unleavened bread. Let's go over to Luke 23. We'll get a little more of the timeline here. Luke 23 and verse 50. Now behold, there was a man named Joseph, a council member, a good and just man. He had not consented to their decision. Indeed, he was from Arimathea, a city of the Jews, who himself was also waiting for the kingdom of God. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then he took it down, wrapped it in linen, and laid it in a tomb that was hewn out of the rock where no one had ever lain before. And that day was the preparation, and the Sabbath drew near. Now we see from John that that preparation, that Sabbath being referred to here, is the first holy day. So Joseph asks for the body. He prepares it as the Sabbath draws near and presumably buries it there sometime. You know, his timeline is pretty compressed, and he's got to prepare the body and get it buried in this new tomb just before sundown. Continuing then in verse 55. And the women who had come with him from Galilee followed after, and they observed the tomb, and how his body was laid. Then they returned and prepared spices and fragrant oils. And they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment. Now, we'll compare this to what we read over in Mark 16. And you'll find that there's a little bit of nuance to the timeline that Luke gives here in verse 56. Hold your finger there in Luke. And let's turn over to Mark 16 and verse 1. Mark 16 and verse 1. Stay with me because this gets a little bit confusing, but it actually becomes very clear once we understand what's being said. Mark 16 and verse 1. Now when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome brought spices that they might come and anoint him. Very early in the morning, on the first day of the week, they came to the tomb when the sun had risen. And they said among themselves, "Who will roll away the stone from the door of the tomb for us?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone had been rolled away, for it was very large. So we see here the ladies have come to the tomb with these spices that they've prepared. And they are there before sunrise on Sunday. And Jesus Christ is already gone. They've already missed him. Right. They get there before sunrise on Sabbath or on Sunday, and Jesus Christ is not there. He's nowhere to be seen. Now, from Mark, we see that the women rested on the Sabbath, the high day, before buying spices. Let's read that again. Now, when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices that they might come and anoint him. Now, if you think of that as referring to the Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath, it would be very interesting for them to be able to wait until after sundown on a Sabbath and go out and buy spices and then come very early on Sunday and anoint his body. But what we see is that the women rested on the Sabbath before buying spices. From Luke, we see that the women prepared the spices and the oils before the Sabbath. Let's read that. Verse 56 of Luke 23 says, "Then they returned and prepared spices and fragrant oils, and they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment." Now, if you try to make that Sabbath reference, if you try to make those Sabbath references into one, to both refer to the weekly Sabbath, then you're in a little bit of a bind, because it looks like they prepared the fragrant oils, they rested on the Sabbath, and then they bought them. You can't really do that. So what we see is that the women rested on the Sabbath, the high day, that first holy day. They rested on the Sabbath, and then they bought spices, and they prepared them. So in Luke 23, it says they returned and prepared spices and fragrant oils, and they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment. They prepared the spices and the oils that day before the Sabbath, and then after the Sabbath, they went to the tomb very early on Sunday. And again, the women arrived at the tomb before sunrise, and Jesus was already not there. So here's the timeline that fits the description that we see here from all of the Gospels when you start looking at all of them and see how it's described. The year that fits this is 31 AD. That's historically where the church is always placed. These events is 31 AD, and when you look at the days there, what you find is that it would have been Tuesday, April 10th, at sundown, is when the Passover would begin. So what we would think of as Tuesday night, Jesus Christ and his disciples would go and they would prepare the Passover meal and they would eat. He would introduce these new symbols, this foot washing. There's all of this that was done And that would have been what we think of as Tuesday night, April 10th, 31 AD. Jesus Christ was up all night. He was tried. He was flogged. He was beaten. On Wednesday, April 11th, sometime before sundown, he would have died, and he would have been buried. Wednesday, April 11th, then, there at sundown, began that first holy day, that Sabbath, that the high day. Thursday, April 11th, at sundown, Wednesday would have been the 11th, Thursday would have been the 12th. Thursday the 12th at sundown, the high day ends. So at that point, at the end of the holy day there, Jesus has been in the tomb for one full 24-hour cycle. Then we see that Thursday, sometime after sundown on that Thursday, after the holy day had ended, and into Friday, somewhere in there, the women would have gone and purchased the spices and purchased the oils and prepared them. And then they would have rested on that following Sabbath day. So that Friday night, the Sabbath begins, the weekly Sabbath, and Jesus Christ has been in his tomb for two 24-hour cycles. And then that Sabbath, the end of that Sabbath, at the end of that Saturday, Jesus Christ was resurrected. He's been in his tomb for that three 24-hour cycles. 3 days, 3 nights, he's in his tomb. And then the ladies, they gather their oils and their spices, and while it's still dark, they run to the tomb, and they're going to anoint his body and prepare it, because they didn't have time to do all of that in all the preparation for the holy days. And then they had to get the oil and the spices and prepare them. And then they had to wait for the Sabbath. And then they needed to go get to the tomb and finally prepare it. And by the time they get there, he's already gone. Understanding the timing of his crucifixion in relation to the days of unleavened bread is really critical to understanding the fulfillment of the wave sheaf. When you look and you recognize that he was crucified and buried during the days of unleavened bread, and that he was resurrected, and that he was presented before God during the days of unleavened bread, and you see that this wave sheaf offering happens here in the middle of the days of unleavened bread, you connect these two, and the meaning becomes all that much more evident. We see that Jesus Christ fulfilled the wave sheaf offering that day after he was resurrected. That same day that the priests would have been offering a wave sheaf offering, that Sunday in ancient Israel, we see Jesus Christ is resurrected and returns to his Father. Let's go over to John 20. John 20 and verse 11. Mary stood outside the tomb weeping, and as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white, sitting, one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. And they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And she said to them, "Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." Now when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, and did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" And she, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." And she turned and said to him, "Rabboni," which is to say, teacher. And Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father." Here we see at that point, presumably this is still early in the morning because she's still hanging out there by the tomb, very upset, right? She's come to prepare a body that was not adequately prepared, and obviously somebody who she loved. And so she's there, still hanging out by the tomb, and has this conversation with Jesus Christ. And he says, I haven't yet ascended to my Father. Again, this is the Sunday after the Sabbath. This is the day of the wave sheaf. Now let's drop down to verse 19. The same day at evening. So the same day, it's the same Sunday. The same day at evening, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood in the midst and said to them, peace be with you. And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his side, and the disciples were glad when they saw the Lord. So Jesus said to them again, peace to you. As the Father has sent me, I also send to you. And so here we see him interacting with his disciples. Elsewhere we see examples where he lets them touch him. We see him more involved, right? It's not the way that he's talking to Mary of, don't cling to me, I haven't ascended to my Father. Here we get the sense that he has ascended to his Father. He's ascended to his Father and been received. Back in verse 17, we see what that means. He says, go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, and my God and your God. He makes it very clear that, look, this is all done now, and now I'm going to my Father, who is also your Father, my God, who is also your God. Something has happened here. Something big, something momentous happened here. He ascended to God, and all of a sudden, he really starts saying, your God, my God, your Father, my Father. Now we see he's very inclusive, because it's possible. At this point, it's finally possible for there to be more than one first fruit. He's been accepted as the first fruit. And now, after he's ascended to his Father, there can be more than one first fruit. The point of all this is that without a Savior, without Jesus Christ, who could live the perfect life that he lived and be resurrected, there could be no later harvest. Without that first harvest, without an acceptable first harvest dedicated to recognize the coming harvests, without that first harvest being accepted, there would be no later harvest, no salvation for mankind. We wouldn't talk about ourselves as first fruits. We wouldn't think of a great harvest of all humanity. There'd be no harvesting without that first of the first fruits. Let's go over to Romans 8 in conclusion. Romans 8 and verse 29. Romans 8, verse 29 says, for whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he, Jesus Christ, might be the firstborn among many brethren. That's the type of first fruits that we recognize and that we see in Jesus Christ. And when we talk about many brethren, we're talking about more first fruits and even later first fruits. But we see something interesting here in verse 29. It's not just that, well, he wanted to resurrect Jesus Christ and then all these others could come later. It says, those he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. If we're going to become the first fruits, if we're going to become part of those many brethren that are being described here, we have to be conformed to the image of the first fruit. So we can't just look at what he did and say, oh, that's really great. That's really nice. God did all this amazing stuff. God says he's calling us to be conformed to his image, to his likeness. He wants us in his likeness. And so he's calling us to be conformed to it. He's calling us to be like Jesus Christ, to have his mind, to walk as he walked. So, as we begin our count toward Passover, we should remember that it begins with Jesus Christ. This whole plan and this whole process and unlocking of all this potential and this opportunity begins with Jesus Christ. And that his acceptance as the first fruit enables us to become first fruits.